I think we can all agree the current political moment is fraught. But how does it compare to the other fraught political moments in history?
It felt for a time in part of that decade like everything was falling apart. Young people against old people, anti-war violence, peace movement.
I'm former U.S. Attorney Preet Bharara. And this week, presidential historian Doris Kearns Goodwin joins me on my podcast, Stay Tuned with Preet. We talk about difficult times in America's history and how its people overcame them. The episode is out now. Search and follow Stay Tuned with Preet wherever you get your podcasts.
Hey, before we get going, I want to tell you a little bit about our sponsor this week, Mubi. You'd think that right now, this juncture in history, it would be really easy to find great stuff to watch. I often find the opposite, and that is why I enjoy Mubi service, which is a curated online cinema that streams amazing films from all over the globe. They send an email, it goes up, it's up for 30 days. That means there's only 30 movies up there at a time, which is just a pleasure, I can tell you. And often when they send out the email, like I'm looking right now at Mia Hansen Loves the Father of My Children, I make a mental note and I'm like, I'm actually going to watch that like this week, like now, not at some distant future date with a log of thousands of things to watch. I've really enjoyed it so far. I think you will too. You can try Mubi free for 30 days at mubi.com/longform. That's mubi.com/longform. Sign up for an extended free trial today and you'll be supporting the show. All right, here is that show. Hey, welcome to the Long Form Podcast. I'm Aaron Lammer here with Evan Ratliff and Max Linsky, my co-hosts on this podcast.
Hey, you guys.
Hey, Aaron.
Great show this week. One I've been trying to set up for a while. Were you going to ask me who's on the show this week?
I was, but you go ahead.
Were you going to ask me something else?
Classic Lammer self-throw.
Hey, Aaron, who's on the show this week?
I'm glad you asked. On the show this week, it's Sheila Hetty. Sheila wrote a book that I really enjoyed called How Should a Person Be? That was a few years ago, and she has a new book out called Motherhood. I know that this podcast is ostensibly featuring purveyors of nonfiction. And her books are really in this interesting place that I don't think fits neatly into fiction or nonfiction. They're often extended ruminations on a single question. Her new book is called Motherhood, and it's basically a 300-page response to the question, should I have a child? And it's really excellent. The person who's talking is Sheila, but she's also not Sheila, and I think her work is it's unlike anything I've ever read elsewhere, and she's really interesting in person also.
I'm excited about this one. I also have long admired her interviews.
She is a person who appreciates the interview form. Her books have a lot of emails and direct conversations between people. I think she's a pioneer in experimenting with bringing the way that people communicate in the modern world into the world of writing. That's very cool. Literally. So
she also did all these great interviews for The Believer.
She's one of the interviews editors at The Believer. So I did talk to her about interviewing and how a Believer interview is formatted as different. I actually did not know what their interview style. I mean, I've been reading them for years, but they actually have kind of a system. So really interesting.
Cool.
As always, we are brought to you by MailChimp. MailChimp makes it easy to start an email newsletter. That's another place that is a place of modern communication style. Hey, the email. Maybe it is the unit of our time. thanks to MailChimp for helping make this show possible.
And now here's Aaron with Sheila Hetty.
Welcome, Sheila Hetty.
Thanks.
You're in town book touring right now?
Book touring, yes.
Is that something you enjoy or do not enjoy?
I don't like getting up in the morning. I wake up and I'm just I would just rather be in bed. But then once I'm actually out of bed, it's fun and fine. And I on this particular tour, in each of the cities I'm going to, I have a friend who's interviewing me, so it makes me look forward to it a lot more because I'm going around seeing people I like, and yeah.
You're the, or have been a interviews editor of The Believer.
Right.
Is that right? What do you think the difference in talking to someone you're friends with versus like a traditional like stranger like me and you?
Yeah.
Right now?
I think it's worse to do an interview with your friends.
Yeah.
I've pretty much stopped. I mean, I'll let them have the misery of interviewing me, but I wouldn't do it anymore. I've had experiences of interviewing friends and it just doesn't work because you end up either like repeating things you already know about the person, so you don't have the genuine curiosity. You're sort of performing curiosity for the sake of the audience, on behalf of the audience. And also, I don't think that chumminess is nice for anybody else to witness in some way.
Yeah.
So I've stopped doing it.
It kind of reminds me of like when you're a kid and you have two people who are really good friends. And then a third person becomes yeah. friends with them. And the other two people have like their inside jokes and their whole, and then it's like injecting this other person into the rhythm. And you're both sort of condescending to them, but also condescending to your own friendship because you have to like sort of dumb it down for the new person.
Yeah, that's perfect analogy.
So you have a new book out. It's called Motherhood. I hope I'm not like oversimplifying by saying the book is more or less you trying to answer the question, like, do I want to have children? And what does that question mean?
Yeah, I don't say me, but...
Okay. Sorry. All right. So this is going to be like a theme. You don't say you. How do you describe?
I say the narrator, the voice of the book.
Okay. And for you, like launching out on a book tour, do readers like draw that distinction? Does it even matter if readers draw that distinction to you?
It does matter. Yeah, it matters because it's different if it's me, Sheila, the person sitting in this chair, versus if it's a construction. Yeah, it's completely different. And it's not like I care so much because I want to protect any kind of privacy I have.
Yeah.
It's just, it's art. It's not journalism. Not that journalism can't have art in it, but to me, the motivations are different. When you edit it, it's different. When you conceive of it, it's different. The point is different. So it's different. But, you know, I think that when I wrote How Should a Person Be, which is my last book, which had the character named Sheila in it, all I was talking about was the difference between me and the character.
Yes.
And that was 2012, and now it's 2018, and I feel like people just get it much better. There's been enough books, there's been enough change in culture, there's been enough that I don't have to talk about it that much. I can just sort of say, yeah, it's the narrator, it's not me, and people go, oh, I get it.
Yeah.
And I like that change has happened in the world.
So was How Should a Person Be, that's the first book of yours I've read, so when did you start writing with a narrator who might be named Sheila?
With that book.
That book,
yeah.
Okay. How deep into your writing life were you at the point when you started that book?
So I published my first book when I was 24, book of short stories. It was called The Middle Stories, and then I published a novel called Tickner a few years later. And then I started writing How Should a Person Be in 2006, so in my late 20s, I guess.
Yeah.
Or around the age of 30, maybe. So yeah, it was fairly... This is my third book.
Yeah.
That's when I started in this weirder vein.
When you came upon that writing style, did it feel like, wow, this is what I've always been looking for? I've always been like driving towards this? Or was it like, this is a weird experiment. This is probably not going to work, but I'm going to see what happens.
It was a bit of both, but it came out of doing interviews, actually. So it came out of a nonfiction form. Mm. So I was recording conversations I was having with friends,
yeah,
sort of before I started thinking of this book, and transcribing them. And when you transcribe, because I love transcribing, I've like always loved transcribing interviews, strangely pleasurable.
We're gonna have to agree to disagree on this one.
Yeah, I just like how different people phrase things. I like hearing voices, you know, translated on you. You're like,
no, I
you're
was actually
crazy.
Someone. Someone had once said that they wanted to do a book that would be like excerpts from this podcast, like kind of put together. And like just the minute like my brain wrapped my head around the fact that we needed a transcription for like 280 hours that had, I was just like, no, we're not going to do that.
It was like one of my first jobs was transcribing this. I'll get back to the book, but there's a documentarian named Jennifer Bachewell. And she did a documentary of Paul Bowles. near the end of his life.
Yeah.
The novelist. And I transcribed, I don't remember how many hours or tapes, but it was months and months. And that was my first experience transcribing. And I like the intimacy that you get with the person that you're, whose voice you're transcribing. Mm. It feels more intimate than if you were just watching the videos, if you were, I think even if you're the person making the videos, because you're so attentive when you're transcribing. And there's like a level of attentiveness and care that like turns into love. And so I always really liked it. So I was transcribing conversations I was having with particularly this friend of mine, a painter named Margot Williamson. And when I was transcribing, I would say, you know, as you do, Margot, and then blah, 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 Sheila, da, 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 da. And when I started pulling some of those interviews, or conversations rather, into the more fictional stuff that I was writing for that book at a certain point, changing the names from Sheila and Margot, which I had written so many times and making these transcripts, just felt like, why am I changing the names? Who am I changing the names for? And I kept trying to change the names, but because the first draft of these conversations had been the real names, it just felt so false. Even though the more fictional writing that I was doing came out of my imagination, let's say, as well as my life. So yeah, it wasn't like, oh, I found, like you asked the question, like, was it like, now I found what I've been moving towards, or was it a weird experiment? It was just like, it was more like, I have to be more natural. Like, I have to have less, I can't put this level of pretense or this level of fakery over it. So I guess that's an experiment, but it's also, yeah, finding something that feels like you're moving. I mean, when you're writing, you're always trying to move towards something that feels more and more true.
When you first started transcribing these first interviews for How Should a Person Be with Margot, like, what surprised you about how the transcript differed from memory, from all of these things that you're like kind of writing in your internal memory chip of your brain, and which is a transcription-like process, but a very flawed, blurry one?
I was amazed at how little there was. When you actually just write down what is said, that's like 15% of the information, less, maybe 7% of the information of what's actually going on in a moment. Mm-hmm. So we were living our lives together, and I was transcribing what we were just saying, walking down the street. You know, it wasn't an interview. It was like, yeah, walking down the street, going to visit art galleries, and you transcribe, and you're like, everything that matters is not here in the transcript, which was kind of interesting. And also, you realize how much assumption there is in conversation, like how much hidden information there is and how much hidden understanding there is that doesn't appear in the words. It's so strange. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah, I mean, it's a bit like where we started talking about the inside joke between the two friends. It's like you need all the subtext.
Yeah.
Like, did you find that as you went on, like in How Should a Person Be, the fourth wall is consistently broken where like Margot is like, I feel weird about how you're taping us right now. Did the knowledge that you were recording yourself start to invade the conversations that you were recording at all?
Yes, but that wasn't a bad thing because the book is about, among other things, the book sort of is about this world in which we are presenting ourselves.
Yeah.
And so it wasn't anything to hide. Mm. And yet at a certain point, you do forget the microphone. I mean, it's like it's a cycle. So you're so conscious of it, and then you forget it. And then you become so conscious of it again, and then you forget it.
Hey, I'm going to pause things here for a quick word from our sponsor, Tripping.com. If you're planning a vacation, particularly a vacation with a group, you may want to consider a vacation rental. They can be more flexible with extra bedrooms, fully stocked kitchens, even hot tubs. You get a little bit more for your money, but it can be really hard to find the right one for your group. You'll probably be going to all kinds of different sites and get totally confused, and everyone will get stressed out and mad at you. There is an easier way, and it is with tripping.com, where one search lets you compare every home from the world's top vacation rental sites in one place. You can save up to 80% on a traditional hotel room, and everyone will think you're great. The whole group will thank you instead of yell at you. This is going to be great for you. So save time and money, get the host you want at tripping.com/longform. That's tripping.com/longform. Find the perfect vacation rental today. Again, tripping.com/longform. Thank you, tripping.com. Here I am back with Sheila Hetty.
There's a conceit in motherhood. Conceit had a weirdly overly negative, whatever the positive version of a conceit, there's a technique in motherhood where you ask sort of Ouija board like questions and then flip three coins to get a yes or no answer. And I feel like a little bit like that's the tape recorder of motherhood, or it's like this framing device. The way I read your answer about the speaking to the recorder is kind of like whatever happens is the right thing to happen. And that's sort of also the coin thing. It's just like whatever direction it goes, we're just going to assume that was the right direction. Yeah. There's no wrong direction.
Yeah, exactly.
Like, how do you navigate in a place where there's no wrong directions? Like, how do you find out where you want to go as a writer?
It's a process of generating a lot of material. Yeah. And then cutting out all the bad stuff. I mean, it's in the writing. For me, it's like years and years of writing and writing as much as I can. Mm-hmm. And I don't have a direction. I don't think this is going to fit here. This could fit here. This holds together this way. I don't care if I write stuff that will have no relationship to anything else I've written, because I know that in the end, I'll find a form and a structure. But in the generating of it, I'm not thinking about that. And then, yeah, in the editing, obviously, you figure out how all those pieces fit together and which ones to throw out.
What's the bad stuff like? Like what?
Bad writing?
Bad
just
writing, like, yeah.
You just look at it and you shake your head. You're embarrassed. You even put it down.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And editorially, like a lot of times normally when I talk to people about like editing work, they're sort of trimming fat. Or they're saying like, yeah, you've already said this here, or like, we need this book to have more of like a straight through. And it seems to me like what you're doing is not, you're not shooting for a straight through, and you're not shooting to remove the fat. If you remove the fat,
there's nothing like, left.
Yeah, it's a
it's
very
fat.
It's a very, very thin animal without the fat.
Yeah.
And in some ways, I think you're like sometimes talking about the nature of fat and how like life is just a bunch of fat all over the place. So when you sit down with an editor, like tell me about like what your goals for improving a book like this are when you're midstream and you have just like pages and pages and pages and they're in different forms and some of them are emails, some of them are transcripts,
yeah.
Some of them are like coin flip sequences. Like, do you have a discussion where you're like, hey, yo, I really think this book only needs 8 of these coin flip sequences and there's 19 of them in here right now?
Yeah, well, I don't show it to an editor until very, very late in the process. I show it to friends a lot.
Uh-huh.
More than the editor is like the very, very end. I don't know why. That's just, I'd rather show it to my friends.
Yeah.
You know? And so I think, well, with motherhood, I just want people to get to the end of the book. So it's like, how do you keep people there?
Yeah.
And I never read books to the end. I always get distracted and start another book. And so
yeah.
That's like really my goal. It's like, how can you keep somebody there?
I just started being an abandoner when I did this show, because it's just
really?
Like naturally you kind of have to abandon. And I have such a strong moral object to it for some reason. I think my mom must have like told me it was bad to abandon books.
Oh,
I had never
no.
abandoned book till
life
I was like
short.
25 years old.
Wow.
But it is liberating abandoning books.
Yeah, but I'm also really, now I've got an app where you can put in the books that you've read. And so
yeah.
I want to get to the end of a book just so I can have another book in my app of like completed books. So it's motivating me to read books to the end. And I'm discovering how nice it really is to read books to the end.
Mm-hmm. Tell me about, in the case of motherhood, what specifically is important about getting to the end of the book for you?
I mean, something big happens emotionally at the end of the book.
Yeah.
And I think there is a feeling of completion. And the book is so much about this wrestling with the question of, you know, do I become a mother? What's my relationship to time? Having a woman's body, being a human. There's just like so much wrestling that I think there is some kind of beauty in even just a pause in that. But yeah, you were asking me about how do you edit and like how do you, like what do you do when the book's all fat, which to me means like you're just, I'm just trying to like represent consciousness of what it feels like to have a brain.
Yeah.
Which is a lot of jumbled things.
Yeah.
And so for me, it was like the middle of the book, like how much wondering and repetition of that wondering is the right amount? Because too much, it's just boring.
Yeah.
Not enough, you don't get the feeling of how exhausting this question is and questioning is. So that for me was, I don't know, maybe the middle should have been a bit longer or something like that. I always still wonder, like, should I have like made it a little even meaner to the audience, let's say. But I think I also wanted to get the sense of time passing. So you need to draw out this ruminating, this frustration with how come I can't answer my own question? How come I can't get to the other side of this? And it was a matter of like taking out the things that sounded too essayistic, because when you are asking yourself questions and trying to solve problems for yourself, you can write things that sound smart and essayistic, but actually when you pay attention to your brain, it's not the smart and essayistic parts that are most interesting. It's the more emotional, like almost self-defeating parts that really create the character of that time of wondering. You know, why can't I come to the end of this? Like, to me, that says more about the dilemma of whether or not to have a child than some smart feminist, you know, whatever comment that you're going to make. That's not the thoughts that happen in your head. That's the thoughts that might happen if you're writing an essay about it, but not if you're like walking through your life with this question.
Something that comes up when I've talked to documentary filmmakers on this show is, you know, you'll set up a whole narrative, you'll follow a court case for 5 or 10 years, and you're like, God, I hope something happens at the end. Like, I hope something great happens in reality so I can end this fucking movie, because
right.
I literally am out of money and I have to go back to teaching. And you set up, I think, very effectively that rumination and that uncertainty in the first part of the book. And since this is not about you, but is about someone who has similarities to you, did you feel a pressure to like have something happening in your life that would feel final for this book, or even to just think of a way to tie the strands together? Because I really didn't know when I was reading Motherhood, like, you set up so many different ruminations, it could end on many, many different notes, but I still felt a pressure. I was like, oh, is she gonna have the baby here just so like we have like a good final scene to this book or whatever? I was like, I cycled through in the same way you do when you're like watching a cable thriller, like all of the possible like resolutions. I was like, oh, maybe she has a baby in the book, but she doesn't have a baby in real life or something.
Yeah.
You know, I was like kind of just like taking it to all the meta extremes. But the book does have to end somehow.
Exactly. Yeah. I mean, no, I didn't feel a pressure to make something happen or like a fear that nothing would happen, because I don't know. I figured, you know, you just need to end on a good line. And I went, when I had that line that I thought, okay, this is a good line to end on, that was a big relief. But no, I wasn't thinking like I need to push my life in a certain way that I can then write about so that the ending of the book is. But I had a friend, a writer, say to me like when I was early on in writing the book, like, you should have a baby, and then the second half of the book is what it's like to have the baby. I was like, I don't think that's like right to have the baby just so I can, you know, write the second half of the book different from the first. But it stuck in my head in this way of like, is this person right? Should I have a baby just because that would be a better book?
Yeah. There was an element to the book where I think you capture really well the judginess of other people and how much this question is about not yourself, but other people's perception of you. And it reflected on me while I was reading the book. I have a 4-month-old child, and I don't want to like totally spoiler the ending, but I was like, you do not have a child. And I was like, I almost felt like I had like bought something on Amazon and then like read the reviews and people are like, it's not that great or whatever. I was like, could you just agree with, like, I already have the baby. So could you conclude that it was a good idea? I mean, I'm not even the woman in this situation, but I still felt this like slight tinge of like, I wish she'd come to the same conclusion that I did.
Yeah. I think we want everyone to do what we do.
Yeah.
Yeah. But wait, you didn't think that the book didn't really make you feel like having a baby was a bad idea, did it?
No, it didn't make me think having a baby was a bad idea. I like it when people consider a question like me. And this is like, I'm being a terrible person right now. I'm like embodying a terrible person, but it's just like, I'm sure if I hadn't had a baby, I would always feel judged by people who did have babies or whatever. It's just right. I think I was actually thinking, because my wife read Motherhood before I did. She read it, I guess maybe right after we had the baby, I think, because it's not very old. And I was like imagining her like reading it as like a woman who's like almost the same age as you, was in like a similar like life point. And I was just feeling things. I was feeling irrational things.
Yeah.
What's it like taking this book out like on the road and like going to like a bookstore of like people who've read the book and have their own life experiences coming to it?
It's not as bad as I thought it was going to be. Okay. I was really scared and really dreading it and really prepared for a lot of hostility or a lot of projection or very personal questions.
Yeah.
I mean, this is only my second stop, so it may still turn out to be all that.
There's still a chance if you want to go judge Sheila in person.
Come see me in Washington tonight. But it hasn't so far been that way. And I feel like, I have to say, you know, with How Should a Person Be, I worried that there was going to be like a lot of creepy guys who like read the sex part and would like send me creepy emails. That didn't happen once.
Really?
Yeah. And maybe people are better than I think. Like maybe people are more respectful than I give people credit for. And that's really not going to happen.
So these are real people in your life who are the subjects of these books.
More so in the last book than this book, really.
Yeah.
This book, there's a lot of composite characters.
Oh, okay. Interesting. Yeah. Okay. But you do have a mother.
I do have one mother.
Like, the narrator of this book has a mother.
Yeah.
And you have a mother.
Yeah.
And I'm guessing that your mother, there's at least like part of the composite character of the mother.
The mother is less of a composite than the friends and the women.
Yeah.
Yeah. The mother in the book is very, very much, you know, my mother is also a serious woman, is also a doctor, is also the child of a Holocaust survivor. Like all that stuff is from my life.
And I think at a point in the book, you send the book to the narrator sends the book to her mother. Now that you're like a little deeper in to like, if that experiment that started with the tape recorder, we're like going on 10 years into that experiment now, 8 years in maybe. What has it been like to do this to the people in your life and to have this like be a part of your relationship, and especially as you've become better known? So I assume that like other people they know have read your books and seen them through that weird prism triangulation.
Yeah, well, it's fun with my mother because I've been sending her the reviews and she's never had much of a relationship to my writing life. It's not anything that she ever seemed to particularly understand or have a personal relationship to. It's just like, good for you, you know?
Yeah.
But now she's reading all the reviews and she's so smart about them. She reads one and she's like, that person didn't get the book at all. And she's very outraged by it. And then she'll read another one and then she'll be like, that's a really smart review. And her idea about which is a smart review and which is not, they're right. Like she gets it. And it's so fun for me to have her on my side going through this. And because we've never had that kind of intimacy around my work.
Yeah.
So it's a real pleasure. And it's also like, I don't feel so alone in it. Like there's something about being reviewed where you feel really, you just feel alone in it. You feel like they're talking about my book and I'm the only one who's having an emotional reaction to the review. You know, everyone else just reads it. It's a review. But for the writer, you're just like, it can hurt, you know?
Yeah.
And, but having my mom, it's indescribably unlonely. Like, it's very fun and I feel very kept company and taken care of or something to have her reading them and responding to them. And I feel like almost like she's in front of me in this phase.
Yeah.
In this way that again, is really new for me in my life, and I love it.
You describe yourself as a younger person, or the narrators describe themselves as younger people, as someone who kind of always knew that you wanted to be in art, that like just to be anywhere near it, it feels like you're just sort of magnetically attracted to the idea of like art culture, just capital art. And it's something I identify with because I've never really known what I wanted to do with my life, but I love that stuff. I also grew up in a family that wasn't the kind of family I grew up in. Like, what do you think put you on this path, do you think? Is it just something inside you?
I think it's just born with it. Like, I just always, when I was a kid, I would act or direct or write or take pictures. When I was a teenager, like, it's just, some people are like that. You just have to have that in your life. I don't know. It's just where I got happiness from. And it's like, why somebody becomes an athlete and someone else becomes an artist. Like, your body was made that way. Your brain was made that way, right?
Yeah. And then there are those kids who are like, you know, the children of professional athletes who become athletes, and that's like a different thing. What did your parents think, particularly when this was just an ambition and you weren't publishing or potentially even writing? What did your parents think of that person you were and wanted to be?
I mean, they were afraid for me. You know, as anybody who has a kid who wants to be a writer, they're like, I think they understood that it was a hard life. It was a life in which you wouldn't necessarily make enough money.
Yeah.
You know, it was a life in which you might be setting yourself up for a great amount of disappointment. So, I mean, my dad's father was a painter. So there was in him this idea that it wasn't so crazy to him, you know, it wasn't so outside his understanding. But yeah, my mom just thought it was a bad idea. And it probably, like, is a bad idea in a lot of ways.
She was totally right.
Yeah, but my dad was, like, supportive, but he was also, like, cautioning.
What do you think it is that changed that you feel like your mom is on your side now, or it seems like maybe even understands your work now?
I mean, I think the book really moved her and really had an effect on her.
Mm-hmm.
So maybe you understand, like, that it's not necessarily a frivolous thing to be doing. If you can be moved by it, maybe it's not just, oh, you're playing, all you do is play. You know, I think my mom always had this idea that, like, writing was playing. And it is playing, but, like, it's a serious kind of playing, you know? And, you know, she's a doctor, so her work is very, she has to get up in the morning, go to the hospital, you know, work long hours. And I think to her, my life looked super decadent. And it is, you know, I don't have to get up in the morning. I can just, like, stay in bed and write. There is a kind of laziness. You might think, oh, my kid is not really doing anything with her days, you know? Why does she get to have so much fun when I'm working so hard?
If the technique of How Should a Person Be was centrally the tape recorder, how did you transcribe these years of your life that are in motherhood?
I just wrote as I was. I mean, for me, discipline in writing is like when you feel the urge to write, you have to write, because that moment, there's something in you that wants to be expressed. And if you miss that moment, it's not like you can write about it tomorrow.
Yeah,
it's now or never. So for me, discipline has always been about paying attention to that urge and going along with it, even if it's sort of inconvenient, even if you're tired, even if the last thing you want to be doing is sitting at the computer. So that if there's a transcribing of my life and motherhood, it was that, like, catch those moments where it feels like there's something to catch, you know? I don't write in the sense of, like, my discipline is not sit down, work for 4 hours, you know, go about the rest of my day.
Yeah. How do you manage the time where you don't feel like writing? Like, what does the rest of your time look like when you're sitting around waiting to feel that way?
Well, I don't sit around waiting to feel that way. I go out with friends. I email. Yeah. I have lots of correspondences with friends.
Yeah.
I spend a lot of time writing emails to friends and responding. And I really like having conversations. I like talking to my friends about their books and their writing projects and,
yeah,
Yeah, and just like reading the internet, reading books.
You said that you, before you talk to an editor, you send portions of the books to friends. Do you talk, like when you're emailing with friends while you're writing a book, do you talk about the book that you're writing and the problems you're having?
Yeah, like, totally.
What is it like being so closely plugged into a critical feedback apparatus at all times?
For the most part, I love it. It's very exciting. It's very alive. But it can be very hard.
Yeah.
I had a friend who read a draft of the book, the first draft that I showed anybody, she read, and a few other people read, but she hated it. And she was just like, this book is bad.
Whoa.
Yeah. And I believed her. And I was like, and not only is it bad, I felt that she was saying, you're bad.
Yeah.
You know, and not only is the book bad, but it reveals things about you that I don't like. And it was incredibly hard. It was incredibly hard for me to work on the book for about 9 months after that. And I'm glad she said it. I think the book is better as a result, but it was really painful. And
when you say the book is better as a result, what effect did that feedback have on the book?
It's hard to say because I don't know what edits I would have done if I hadn't received her response.
Yeah.
So I can't really remember what I thought. I think I sort of thought the book was basically pretty close to being done. And she was like, it's not even close. And so, I don't know. I forget your question.
Well, it was just like
I'm emotionally undergoing this all over again.
I guess it just sounds difficult to me to have a sea of voices like that in here. Like I've heard of people like, who
it's
have sort of one trusted reader or whatever. But as you open up to multiple viewpoints, how do you keep that from just, like if someone says, this is great, like don't change a thing. Another person's like, I don't like this book and I don't like you anymore. Like, how do you find a common ground there in your own head editorially?
I don't know. I mean, when I showed that draft to that friend, I also showed it to another friend who loved it. So I was buoyed by that, you know?
Yeah.
If I hadn't showed it to the friend who loved it, I think I would have maybe thrown the whole thing out. It's possible that I would have just said, I failed, you know, forget this. But I think it's better to show it to more people rather than fewer, because then you can sort of synthesize in your head like this editor, you know, and you can take the things that are useful to you. And I can say in my head to my friend that didn't like the book, well, I think these things are right and these things are wrong. But I was just so angry at her when I was editing it. And I think I was like, there was a bit of I'll show you.
Yeah.
Which is not a bad thing to feel when you're writing. Like, I'm going to make this so good.
Yeah.
You know.
I remember when I read How Should a Person Be? It was one of the first books I read that I felt like was written in a modern language or the language I had grown up in. And now I'm literally like reading another book right now, Mary H.K. Choi's book that is all messaging.
Okay.
And I know that there's a natural pushback against it. Like, I know that there's naturally someone who you can write a book, and it doesn't matter if it's your book or HK's Choice book, anyone who is starting to embrace language in this kind of a way that you could just be like, you know, when you said that you were trying to get less essayistic, I love essays and I hate this. Like, how do you deal with that there could be a natural, like, negative reaction? Like, you could read a review that's just like, I hate this. It's just like someone talking about their interior monologue. And you're like, yeah, I wrote a book that was someone talking. If you didn't have to read the book. I could have told you would have not liked it if you don't like X.
Yeah. It's exactly what you just said. Like, of course, no matter who you are, people are going to hate your book.
And yeah.
It's not your problem.
When you started writing in that way, did you naturally like it, or did you go like, do I hate this?
Yeah, I mean, I wasn't in love with it. I didn't think like, this is a beautiful new form, you know? It was just what had to be in the book. And that book was supposed to be sort of ugly, you know? And so it did seem kind of unformed. Not that it wasn't shaped, but it did seem kind of, it didn't look like another book to me. So the only things that look good are things that look like other things. You know, if something doesn't remind you of something that you already take for beautiful, it's kind of confusing to know what it is. Like, I still can't quite see what the shape of that book is. Even though I shaped it for so long, I still can't quite keep it all in my head in some way. I mean, but I feel like when I'm writing, that's the hardest part, is to like keep that whole thing in your head. And for me, it's just, you end up reading the book like 100 times, 60 times or something, just to sort of memorize it. Because you can't, I think I have to like see the beginning, the middle, the end, and all the scenes as like looking at a painting. You sort of want to be able to just like glance at it and see everything.
Yeah.
And that's really hard to do with a novel, because something about how memory works, if I'm writing a book, I can't remember the other scenes while I'm working on one scene. There's a weird thing that happens. It like blanks out or something.
I actually was thinking about this while I was reading your work, which is, in some ways, narrative, like a strong sense of narrative, is like a cliff notes for like remembering, keeping it in your head. You're like, oh, and then like they killed the secretary. Okay, I remember that. Like, you know, like that's sort of like how Prestige Cable right now is like the episode, and it's like, and it ends on a cliffhanger, and then it goes next one, and it's partially like keeping in your head. It's like, oh, you pick up the next week and you're like, all right, I remember the cliffhanger from last week. There's nothing to catch in the kind of writing you do. I don't know how you could keep this much writing in your head, and then if you read it 100 times so you can finally get it all in your head, you're now having a very different experience than your intended reader who's reading it once.
Yeah.
Do you ever like try to put yourself in the head of someone who's reading it once, or worry I should stop like reading this over and over again?
No, I mean, that's why I have friends read it. Because then if a friend reads it for the first time, they can say, oh, you didn't say this very obvious fact, you know, about this character that would really help the story make sense.
Yeah.
Because I would miss that. And so, yeah, I mean, with this book, I probably had 20 friends read it, you know, at different points. And I rely on that, other people having a first reading of it.
Part of what I feel like holds it together, even though you can't get a foothold in the narrative in that way, is that it feels like it has certain like rules. Like, in How Should a Person Be? It's like the tape recorder is kind of a rule, which is, we're just going to keep recording these conversations, even if they don't go anywhere, even if you're uncomfortable. Like, it feels like a game or an exercise in a way. Once you've set out these sort of rules, like, it feels a little bit like when you're conceiving of a book, it almost feels like a board game.
Right.
You're like, I'll do this, this, and this, and then I'll like, whatever happens, we'll like write about it. Do you struggle with issues of like bending the rules? Like, let's say in that, like, Margot says something and you've got on the thing, you're like, kind of better if she had said it a little bit more like this, or like, I don't like that point in between those two statements. That doesn't work with what I was trying to do.
Yeah, that's editing. I mean, that editing is not bending the rules.
Yeah.
But I do think, I mean, you're right. Like, for me, each book has its own rules.
Yeah.
But there is not the rule, do not make this better.
Like, what do make good rules? Like, what have you learned about rule making?
I mean, like you say, it's a game. Like, it's and if you cheat, it's less fun. So, for instance, with the coins, like, people ask me sometimes, well, did you ever, you know, if the coin said yes, did you ever just make it no? I'm like, that's no fun for me, you know? So, no, I never did that. So it's fun to follow rules. If you know.
So it's fun to follow the rules. You like following the rules.
What
but did you
rules?
Hit a point where you said, Jesus, I really wish I could break this rule? Like,
no, I don't think so, because the rules aren't written down where I'm like, here are the 10 rules. It's just the rules are in your body. It's just like a feeling, you know, like any kind of writing. You have your rules, but you could never articulate them. It's just like, this would feel wrong in this book, you know? It's like an instinct, maybe, what the rules are.
When you set up a series of rules like that, or prompts like that, I remember like reading about how they did the Ally G show. If you watched the Ally G show,
sure.
So like, there's writers on the Ally G show, and you're like, well, why are there writers? It's improvised. And it's like, well, what we would do is we'd look at a bunch of scenarios and be like, if we go do this, what will the other person do? And then what could we do in response? And basically, like, almost look at it like as like improvisatory theater and think about all of the possible choose your own adventure strands and try to write jokes within that. So once you've created those rules, do you start seeing like all the different places it could go?
Not in the way that of this Ally G writers. I don't think so. I don't think I see it that way.
Do you
it's
see
more
all,
like
all the pranks ahead of you.
I don't know. I got to say, like, it's, there isn't a flow chart. So I think what you're talking about with the Ally G thing is like a bit of a flow chart. Like, if you go, then you go in this direction and then you follow this path. But with the book, it's not anything like that. It's more just, I mean, for me, the hard thing about writing the book was what comes first, what comes second, what passage comes third, like just ordering it.
Yeah.
And what's the order going to be? And the order, I think, among other things, is like stupider to less stupid. Like you want to think, the longer you think about something, the smarter your thoughts about it get. So I try to put the things at the beginning that would have seemed like the kind of things that you would have had at the beginning of this ruminating, and then
that's interesting. So like in some ways you have to imagine yourself early in the book in the past with less knowledge. You can't like time machine back things you've learned later in the book.
Yeah, because you don't feel like you're going on a, I don't like the word journey, but you know.
So you've been, as we said, like at it for 10-ish years. Like, what's this life like that you're leading? You know, you've done these books. These books kind of like are like 3-4+ years in your life. How do you organize yourself? Like, how do you organize making money? What's this writer's life like for you?
Well, after How Should a Person Be? So I was in my mid-30s when it came out. I was able to support myself from my books. Before that, I was doing a lot more journalism. I was writing for magazines. Mm-hmm. When I was in my early 20s, I worked at a magazine called Shift, which was a magazine based in Toronto, sort of like a, we always called it the Canadian Wired, you know, like everything in Canada is like the Canadian, New York Times, the Canadian, da, da, da. So it was always like just like every writer cobbling together money from wherever you can.
Yeah.
You know, sometimes it's temping, sometimes it's journalism, sometimes it's, but yeah. And then with Motherhood, I got an advance that let me write it. And that's sort of my dream, because I still love writing book reviews and I still love doing interviews, but I don't want to have to do it for money. I want to have to do it just because I'm really interested in it and I want my books to make me money. So because I don't think there will ever be a time in my life where I don't want to write books, but I think there are many times in my life where I don't want to do journalism.
What was it like doing journalism during that period? Like some of the ways you've talked about your fiction as is like stripping away the techniques of journalism from it. I'm trying to think. I remember you writing a profile of Raffi that I really enjoyed. That was New York Magazine?
Yes.
So when you are forced into journalism against your will, and you're simultaneously, I'm thinking, probably writing these books while you're doing it, what was that like?
Well, I mean, sometimes it's a good break.
Yeah.
And sometimes it's just nice to finish something and see something in print.
Yeah.
Because it's 7 years before the book's in print, you know, from the moment you start writing it. For me, this was, I started writing it in 2010 and it's only coming out today, yesterday.
Yeah.
You know, so that's 8 years. Like that's just, you have as a writer, like you just want to see your byline. Like you want to see it on the page, you know?
Yeah.
It gives you a sort of self-esteem or something. I completed it and somebody published it. And so I like doing those things. Like I liked the Raffi piece because I was really interested in Raffi and I wanted to meet him and I wanted to write the piece. And like that was fun. I don't really like the fact that he didn't like the piece.
Oh, interesting.
So that kind of, I don't think I have the disposition really to be a true journalist because I don't want the person that I'm writing about to feel bad, you know?
Same.
Yeah, and that's a liability. Like you have to not care.
I think it's for me, a shortcoming even in an interview sometimes is that like, if I had the perception that you were uncomfortable right now and like that would like very much throw off my energy, like why did Raffi dislike that piece?
I mean, the piece started with this, I reread it recently. I hadn't read it since it was published and I didn't reread the whole thing, but I started reading it and I stopped and I thought, oh, I get it now. The beginning of the piece is me wondering whether Raffi has sex with any of the people that loved his music, like his grown-up fans who were fans when they were children. I don't know how to put that. Not his child fans. His formerly child fans.
Yeah.
Because he had, when I interviewed him, he had a kind of very flirtatious vibe. And I think that if you're a child entertainer, that's not the kind of publicity you want.
Right.
So he didn't retweet it. He never said anything to me about it. Mm. And maybe he doesn't retweet the article. But like, I really got the sense that even his publicist heard, gave me the cold shoulder after that. And I didn't want him to dislike the piece. I wasn't trying to hurt him or get him in trouble or anything. he's like a rock star for children.
Yeah.
And when I went to his concert, there were a lot of grown women with their children. And the grown women were like, they were losing their shit a bit, you know?
Yeah.
And especially when they went to meet him, they were like blushing and like stuttering. And I was like, do these women want to have sex with Rafi? And then when I talked to interviewed various friends and this one friend of mine who's a poet, she was like, yeah, I remember being like 6 years old and like lying in bed listening to Rafi and having like sexual feelings in my body, like loving his voice, feeling very, maybe not sexual, but like a feeling of very, I can't remember the word she used, but it had that feeling.
Uncontrollable emotion.
Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, I like, even like most of the like artists I like when I was that age, I guess were men, and I'm heterosexual ostensibly, but like, you're kind of experiencing charisma for the first time.
Yeah, yeah.
And like animal magnetism.
Yeah.
You're like, what does this guy got? Like,
yeah.
I don't have it. Like,
yeah.
he's huffing some kind of fumes that are like propelling him forward.
Yeah. And not all child singers have that charisma.
Yeah.
Or that sort of sexuality, I guess.
Yeah.
And it was interesting also about Rafi, he didn't set out wanting to be a children's entertainer.
Yeah.
He set out wanting to be like a Bob Dylan, like he didn't have any sense that there were kids were going to be his ultimate audience.
Yeah.
So that's interesting.
Yeah, I think it's always interesting when people like are wildly successful, but like would like to be maybe even less successful, but in a slightly different version of the thing.
Yeah.
So that was your like journalistic foray, which you're like still kind of doing on and off. And you've also done the interviewing stuff with The Believer. At a certain point, like, are you just ever like, this would be easier for me to just interview people or just to run like raw transcripts? Like, it seems like you're like cutting away layers deeper and deeper towards what is ultimately just like human speech, like unfettered human speech. Tell me about like the difference between interviewing someone and just publishing that versus the more transcription based, like How Should a Person Be style, where you're kind of like creating fiction out of real words.
I mean, it's different and the same. I mean, when I edit my own interviews for The Believer,
yeah,
the interviews that I've done with writers or artists, I do think of it a little bit like I'm crafting a little play or something. So there is a sense in which it's almost less of a transcription than the transcripts that I put into How Should a Person Be, which I really wanted to leave raw and kind of the way conversation actually is. But if it's an interview, I want it to have an arc, and I want to move things around as much as I need. And I want it to have like pauses, like almost like acts. I mean, the interviews in The Believer they're broken up into different parts, I guess, you know?
Yeah.
You come to the end of a part.
By
and
topic,
it,
kind of, yeah.
By topic or by, that's a really good sentence to end on. Let's let that have its own space and then start a new section. So.
Was that format already in place at
yes.
The Believer when you inherited it? So that's just how The Believer
does it
when it
yeah.
comes to an interview.
Yeah.
Interesting.
And it's nice because you do then linger on that thought and then you move on to the next section.
What strikes me as different about that Believer style interview than your books is like in a Believer style interview or like a magazine profile, you're doing something simple, which is answering a question in the same way. Does Rafi sleep with the adult version of his child fans? Something like that. Well, everyone gets what we mean. But in those contexts, you answer that question pretty rapidly. You're like, we're starting now.
Right.
And in 20-ish minutes, we're going to be done with this question. Whereas in your books, you're asking a question. You're like, we got to span this question over 4 to 5 years. So like, let's not come to any conclusions too quickly.
Yeah, but they're also harder questions.
Yeah, they're harder questions. So do you like, when you're thinking about interviewing, do you think about like what scale of question or what scale of like a topic for a Believer interview fits nicely into that format?
No, I ask the questions I'm genuinely interested in asking and try to ask questions that are possible to answer, because sometimes interviewers will like ask questions that I'm like, you couldn't even answer, like nobody could answer that question, you know? But I think also another difference, I was thinking about this, is like when I edit the interviews for The Believer, I want the person that I've interviewed to seem as smart as possible. And with the books, I'm not trying to make anyone seem as smart as possible,
yeah.
you know? I want it to be as we are.
What do you do to make someone seem as smart as possible?
It's in the editing. You know, you make them, you take out the dumb things they said.
Yeah.
You clean up the sentences in such a way that they're more articulate.
Yeah.
But never so much that they would say, that isn't me. That doesn't sound like me. So my ideal is, because at The Believer, we always send the interviews to the subject and they can respond and change or whatever. And my hope is always that they'll read it and be like, yeah, that's exactly what I said. And that's the order in which I said it. And that's me. So to edit it, but not beyond their own recognition of themselves.
Wow. So you let them edit. Like, what do people do given the ability to edit themselves in that way?
People don't do anything, mostly.
Interesting.
There was one person who edited his interview a lot, really basically rewrote it, and he's a writer. And I just had to say, like, it was actually better before. And he didn't quite believe me, but let me keep the original.
That's interesting. I mean, we on this show will allow people like to take things out if they say something like insulting that they didn't do it. But I would never give the ability of someone to just like, you know, repurpose stuff, because I feel like we'd be in like a year long back and forth like about every single little thing.
Yeah.
You know?
And that policy was in place before I was at The Believer. So I don't know why they chose that. But I think it's for that exact reason. You don't want somebody to. I actually don't know why they put that in place, because it's very unconventional. But it seems right to me.
It does to me, too. It's sort of it positions the interview more as a collaboration and less one-sided.
Yeah.
Which I like in theory, although I would hate if I had to be a part of that collaboration every month or every quarter, you know.
Maybe it's taking over from the Paris Review tradition of the interview being a collaboration. Maybe that's why The Believer decided to do that. I don't know.
So where do you go from here? What's next? What's
writing wise?
Yeah, just like, I don't know. Like, do you, when you come to an end of a book like this, is your life just like a blank canvas, or have you already started in the next phase?
It's a bit of both. Like, I'm touring for most of May, and then my hope is June, July, August is just like a summer, you know? Like,
yeah.
I want to hang out and just sort of relax. And I have things that I'm working on, but I'm not going to work on them in any super industrious kind of way. I want to read a lot of books and, yeah, I just kind of feel like reading and lying in the grass and, you know, and letting whatever ideas I have for new things just sort of lie in the grass with me.
Well, thank you so much for doing this interview.
Yeah, thanks.
And that was the Long Form Podcast. Thanks very much to Sheila Hedy for coming in on her book tour. Thanks to my co-hosts, Max Linsky and Evan Ratliff. Thanks to our editor, Janelle Pfeiffer, our intern, Angela Velez. Thank you to our sponsors, Tripping.com and Mubi. Hey, let's talk about Mubi. I always want to stream something at night. It's like something I like do before I go to bed. And often I spend all of the time that I should be streaming something sitting there trying to figure out what I'm going to watch, trying to find something good to watch, and failing. That's where Mubi enters. It's a curated online cinema that streams exceptional films from around the globe. Each day a new film. They're only up for 30 days, so that means there's only 30 movies up at a time, and you better watch them, and they are great. I've really been enjoying it. I think you will too. Go to mubi.com/longform, mubi.com/longform for an extended free trial, free for 30 days. You could watch 30 movies in those 30 days. I challenge you. Okay, thank you to Mubi, and we'll be back next week.